If it's happening now, we're talking about it. This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson on 900 CHML.
Hey, it's Hamilton Today. I'm Curtis Thompson, Scott's son. Major Tom McKay is on the board. Jordan Armanis is booking the guests. In the legendary CHML newsroom, Dave Woodard and Jennifer McQueen. Here's Scott Thompson.
It is Hamilton Today. I'm Scott Thompson, 900 CHML. All right, it was, before we tell you what's coming up on the show, so this is kind of funny, and, you know, every so often I share a personal story, and this one's kind of funny this morning, because, you know, I can't hear, you know, I'm deaf, and it's just because of, 40 years of doing this, and, 20 years talking too much, and 20 years before that, listening to music really loud through headphones for long periods of time. So anyway, a couple of years ago, I guess it's been happening for a few years now. Everybody's going like, honestly, in the house, like, stop saying pardon, stop saying excuse me, go get your dang hearing checked. And I'll get to that and so on and so forth. So we went on a trip. And we went to Mexico, and it seems every time I go to Mexico, I get sick. So clearly not enough tequila. So I don't know, like day five in there and or down there, and I wake up, and I notice I cannot hear out of my right ear. It's my left ear that's the bad one. I said it's my left ear that's the bad one. So because I had some bug or whatever down there, it plugs up your ears. So once I lost the sound of the right ear, I was done. And you might remember me telling that story on the air. And long story short, had to go to the hospital because my ears were not draining, or the one good one wasn't. And, you know, going for that surgery that kids get all the time when their ears are plugged. And interesting, when I go into this office, it's either really, really young people or it's really, really old people that are. And sure enough, I remember when I got my surgery, I'm sitting in that, you know, the gown and your arse hanging out the back and all that sort of stuff. And all the kids running around in these striped pajamas. It's like, am I the only one here that's over the age of 10? Anybody? Do you want me to read you guys a story or anything? Speak up. I can't hear you. So anyway, I go and I get the surgery done, and I don't know what it's called, but you all know, everybody's heard about it. If you can hear, of course. And, you know, miraculously when it's over, I can hear because I've got the hearing in my right ear back. So things continue, whatever. And I'm going back for my yearly, inspection and, the tube's still in. That's good. But you're still deaf because I was kind of going in. And, over the course of the year, like, you know, again, the hearing was great in the first little while because you're draining. You're like an air conditioner with the hose coming out of it in the summertime, and it's leaking all over the people in this. That was my ear. So I know, I hope you're not eating lunch. So anyway, so immediately it was great, but then, you know, it sort of starts to taper off again and blah, 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 blah. So, they basically said to me today, like, you know, it's not like you're an old person and you're gradually losing your hearing. Your hearing test is exactly the way it was 1 year ago, which is good news. But, the bad news is you still can't hear. So anyway, that's where I am. And the good news, it isn't getting any worse, but it's also not getting any better. And here's another thing she told me, every time you put on your headphones, like are on now. And of course I got a stack of Marshall amps beside me here that teenage head would love. That's what's powering my headphones. And well, not quite, but you know, but she said every day you do that, you're just aggravating it even more because you've already done nerve damage to your left ear. That's not coming back. But I've got tinnitus, which is the ringing in your ear, which you just get used to after a while. And you wonder why I'm nuts. So anyway, she said that just aggravates that and it just makes it worse. And so really you're kind of poking the bear here. So, then it was, so do I get hearing aids? Do I get one hearing aid? Do I do this? Do I do that? And, you know, they all think it's like a stigma thing. I don't give a crap about the stigma. It's like, I don't want to pay for them. And, you know, insurance covers a certain amount, but you know what I mean? So, it's like kind of, you know, it's like putting shingles on your roof. It's like, I got to pay that money and that's all I get is to hear. I know. I'm not going there. So anyway, that's where I am right now. So it was interesting. Once again, another interesting visit to the hearing doctor. So I guess I'm going back next week, and they're going to run me through the demo thing again. So, you know, I don't know if they're going to give me some to try or whatever, because I don't know, like, can I wear them with my headphones on? Do I take my the hearing aids out, then I put my headphones on? You know, Major Tom's already complaining they're so loud that, you know, he's getting feedback. You know, not for Major Tom, it's just not a case of hitting all the buttons and stuff. He's actually got to, like, tune the show like he's, you know, one of those guys at a mixing board at a concert, because there's so much feedback.
Scott, I'm actually curious about this. If you were to get those hearing aids, though, like, and they do cause feedback, wouldn't that just cause feedback upon feedback upon feedback upon feedback upon feedback upon feedback in the headphones until everyone just blows up?
I'm sorry, did you say something? Let's bring in Tom Wilson. Where do you start? Mohawk, modern Mohawk visual artist, Juno Award-winning musician, Lee Harvey Osmond, Blackie and the Rodeo Kings, Junk House, best-selling author of Beautiful Scars, Let's Not Forget the Order of Canada, and now Beautiful Scars hits the stage. Tom Wilson is here. Tom, thanks for the time. I hope you're doing well.
How the heck are you? Good to be talking to you.
It's great to talk to you. And before I start, as we're playing Junk House coming in, my condolences, the passing of Russell. My goodness. You know, it's amazing how you all just keep moving forward. But my condolences, and I hope you're all doing well.
A total heartbreak. It was, you know, losing Russell, he was a spirit that I didn't think would ever leave this planet, you know. So thank you for that, Scott.
All right. What are you doing now? I mean, this opens coming up April 24th. That, of course, is the play, Beautiful Scars, Theater Aquarius. It's running from April 24th to May 11th. At this point, what is going on? It must be just a buzz around there.
It is insane. We're doing 10-hour days. I've been sitting for over 2 weeks. As the actors and the carpenters and the lighting people, there's like a 40-person staff working on this right now. But I've been sitting doing rewrites all the way along, because you get to hear your words and you get to hear your story back by magnificent actors and actresses. And from that, you realize that the emotion and the message is in the space between the words. And this play, this musical, is a celebration of identity, a celebration of Indigenous culture, and a celebration and the hope that we can start a conversation and have some action in this country, which is desperately needed at this time.
How did this play come about? How did it make it from book to stage?
Just like everything else in my life, Scott, I just stumble through life and things happen. The honest answer is the cosmic answer is that when you open up your heart and you have an opportunity to speak the truth, really great things come to you. I didn't ask to write a book. I never thought I'd write a book. Random House came to me and said, have you ever thought about writing a book? I said, hell no, that sounds like way too much work. But I wrote the book and it became a bestseller, and then it became a movie. And because of the interest from the theater world, from the interest from my co-writer, Sean Smythe, from Mary Frances Moore, who runs Theater Aquarius, this is taking the stage this week. It opens, I believe, this Friday, and it's running for 2.5 weeks. So it goes to May 11th, and I'm really excited about this. This is the very first autobiographical Indigenous story to ever be put on a stage anywhere in the world. And it took Mary Frances Moore to welcome the Indigenous world into the theater, a place that they usually don't have a voice and they usually don't feel comfortable. This is a play that addresses everybody in a loving tone. And once again, this play is a celebration of identity.
Through your stories, your book, the documentary, and now the play, we've seen the story of your life unfold. And I've said to you many times, you know, it's just inspiring to watch you evolve in all of this. But do you look at your life differently? I mean, you know, obviously it's cathartic to get all this out, but do you look at your life differently when you see it in a documentary or in a book or on a stage? Does it make you, well, do you learn from that?
It's all my creation. It's all my words. It's my writing. It's my poetry. So I'm ready for it. What I wasn't ready for was the emotional impact from the actors acting it out on stage.
Wow.
I mean, I was moved in the documentary when my mother found that the camera and the microphones and the crew were her confessional. And she said things that none of us had ever heard before in that documentary, Beautiful Scars. And now writing this and having it performed, having it come back to you, you know, it's a big emotional chunk. You know, that's all I can tell you. It's been quite an experience.
It's interesting, the same story, basically, but, you know, presented three different ways, and you're getting a different emotion almost from each, or growth from each stage of this. How do you decide, how do you pick what works in a doc, a book, and what works on a stage? Like, you're talking about going through rewrites right now.
Well, you know, that's a fantastic question, Scott, because that is what it takes. It takes hearing the words that you thought were perfect, Scott. I've written the perfect dialogue, you know, for this character. And then it comes out and it either sounds clunky or it's not the way you wanted to say it. Or maybe you felt too aggressive when you were writing it. Maybe you weren't speaking in a loving tongue, and it gives you the opportunity to shape that conversation and make it the way you want it to be.
Are you anxious or nervous about this as opening night approaches?
Well, I'm not going on stage, Scott. Let's just start with that. My son is playing me. Thompson Wilson is playing a young version of me in the play.
So
I'll ask him if he's nervous. I am not.
So what is that like for him? What's that like for your relationship with him?
Well, we're pretty tight. I mean, we've been writing music. We've been doing movie soundtracks together. We have a great working relationship. And we have a great relationship as father and son. And we know that these relationships between fathers and sons can be, you know, pretty tumultuous. And ours has been, too. But the creative ties have drawn us closer together. We see each other clearer. And that's a bit of a side gift to this whole process, Scott.
Who knows what is next, but congratulations again and again and again, and good luck to you with all of this venture.
Thank you. May I just mention, Scott, a portion of the proceeds, my end of it, are going to my scholarship, the first Indigenous scholarship at McMaster University, which anybody can donate to by going online. So I just wanted to mention that, too. Thank you.
All right, Tom, good luck with all of this. Obviously, this weekend through May 11th at Theater Aquarius, stage version of Beautiful Scars. Good luck, Tom.
Thanks, Scott. We'll talk to you soon.
There's an interesting article and an interesting report involving Dr. Meg Holden, professor, urban studies, professor of resource and environmental management, Simon Fraser University. Do you know your neighbors? If I asked you right now, okay, who lives next door to you? And then next door to them, then next door to them, then let's do that on the other side. What about across the road? What about across the hall, down the hall, what have you? And has that changed over time? Dr. Meg Holden, professor, urban studies, professor of resource and environmental management, Simon Fraser University here now. Doctor, thank you for the time. I hope you're doing well.
Hello, Scott.
This is fascinating. And in this article, I saw the mention of block parent, which, man, I remember when I was a kid, you used to see the signs in the windows, the red signs, red and white signs, block parent. And if you got into trouble, you could always run to a block parent house. Is that even around anymore?
It exists. It still exists. But like with some of these other kinds of old fashioned ideas that we have about how to be a good neighbor, the block watch, you know, just the sort of idea of a block party or asking the neighbor to pick up your mail for you when you're away, borrowing a cup of sugar. This our work on neighboring has really been looking at how the definition of what being a good neighbor has changed.
Obviously, you can see how that has changed over years, over decades, what have you. But you put a global pandemic in there. How does that alter all this discussion?
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, I'm based in Vancouver. I grew up in Ontario, but, you know, the situation in terms of rapidly decreasing housing affordability, high rates of newcomers and urban development as well. You've got compounding that, the pandemic, and a lot has changed about how we behave at home that has to do with what's safe, what's not safe. A shocking number of Canadians during the pandemic didn't even speak to a single other person for in the past month when that was polled by a major polling company. And so we really need, I think the kind of takeaway of our study is that we really need to think and invest some time and energy into rethinking how we support the notion of neighboring and kind of convince people that it still matters. Because if we don't put those measures in place, then a lot of people are just not going to go back to seeing that it's important to know who their neighbors are, like you said, their first names at least, to have somebody to call on when there's a heat wave and they need help getting out of their house. We talk to people whose elevator has been out of service for years. And if you have a setback and you can't get around the corner for ice or milk or what have you, then you still need neighbors.
I remember at the early stages of the pandemic, at 7 o'clock, people were going outside and banging their pots and pans and everybody, oh, hey, how you doing? Oh, woo, woo. And then halfway through, it became very divisive. And, you know, people go to this side or that side of the room, what have you. And we really haven't seemed to come out of that, have we?
I think there's a lot of an entrenched feeling of isolation. So we find that loneliness is related to social isolation, right? That if we feel left out, then we're more likely to think that that's an intentional thing that other people are doing to us, that there's something that is wrong with us or wrong with other people. And we're less likely to think that it's not going to hurt us to reach out in a friendly or at least a neutral way, just to say, hey, you know, this could be mutually beneficial for us to keep the path clear for my stroller or my bicycle or, you know, basic, you know, trash pickup would be a common thing that neighbors would be able to come to some agreement on. So there is this sort of sense that we've fallen into some habits that were essential for public health. And now right. We need to relearn some of those old habits in new ways with our new neighbors.
So how does density play into this? Because obviously, as you said, a lot of rapid population growth, a lot of people are pushing for more urban density and such, and you can understand the arguments there. You know, but I can think anecdotally, a friend of mine who lived in an, you know, typical urban subdivision, then moved out into the boonies around Peterborough somewhere, and he's pretty much in a farming community. He goes, I know more of my neighbors now who live like, you know, a half a field across this way or that way than I did when I had all these people living around me. How does density play into all this?
Yeah, thanks. And I think you said it to yourself when you were sort of reminiscing about the Blockwatch program, that we have these ideas about neighboring behavior. One of the classic survey questions for neighboring, for testing whether or not a neighborhood is neighborly or not, is to say, if you found a wallet on the sidewalk containing, and there's a $100 bill inside it, how likely do you think it is that it would be returned to you? Well, if you're in a farming community or if you're in any kind of a rural community where having some sense of who your neighbor is and what their, you know, what their lifestyle looks like, it's much more obvious that's going to be important to you. In an urban environment where there are a lot of newcomers, there are a lot of people who come and go at different times of day, you'd be much less likely to think that you had a shot at getting your wallet back if you lost it on the street. So what's that about? And how can we arrange our densifying neighborhoods and our neighborhoods with lots of newcomers and lots of difference in them so that we are creating those same kinds of conditions for mutual support when it comes down to it? And that means, So it's really about tolerance, right? It's about coming to be tolerant of one another, even when, you know, some of us might like dogs, others don't like dogs. Some of us might, you know, work in different industries or not agree with one another politically. But we still want to know that when there's an emergency, when we're feeling really low and we just need somebody to recognize us, that that's going to be possible.
You'd think if you're in a more dense situation, you're closer to people, you'd be more apt to chat with them. Why is that not the case?
Privacy. People prefer to maintain their privacy because they aren't so sure that they're going to be accepted or what they have to chat about is going to be something that is of any interest to their neighbor. We found that there's a lot of a sense of not of wanting to avoid the gossip, of not wanting to get involved, that it could come back and make it uncomfortable for them to then pass their neighbors in the hallway or to kind of be stuck with them in the elevator. People have had some really bad experiences, and especially when we're talking about people who are renters or who are living in community housing or in situations where they don't have a lot of options about moving, which is more and more of us, right? That they're less likely to want to stick their nose into something that could cause problems for them where their housing is concerned, because it could be really it could be really devastating.
Dr. Meg Holden with us, professor of urban studies and professor of resource and environmental management, Simon Fraser University. Higher density living, changing the way neighboring works in Canada. Fascinating. Meg, thanks so much for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
Thank you very much.
Taylor Swift fans got a piece of the new album, and it was it leaked? Is it? Well, you know, this is all the music business. Let's bring in Eric Alper, music publicist and commentator. He's here now. Eric, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
I am well. I'm exhausted. I have not slept since yesterday morning. I was expected, like most of the world, to start listening to a 16-song album from Taylor Swift starting at midnight, and was just about going to bed at about 1:49 in the morning, and then all of a sudden she dropped another 15 songs at 2 o'clock in the morning. 31 songs total. It's a double album now, and I'd like to see just how many girls between the ages of 12 and 25 showed up for school today.
Wow. Your reaction to that, because we all know how it used to be done, but you know, you'd release an album, you'd release a pre-single to try to drum up interest for it, and now to just unload the whole thing. Clearly she's been busy, but your thoughts?
Yeah, so many things unpacked there. You know, at about 7 o'clock yesterday night, there was word online that the album had leaked, and there are a couple of reasons why and how that happens. There's, you know, still a couple of dozen people that have access to music before the rest of the world hears it. All the music streaming services, all the retailers who need to put out their copies for, say, midnight if they're going to stay open, or for tomorrow morning, and then that leaks. But I was a little bit skeptical. I thought maybe it was like somebody generating music from AI, or that it was just all a joke. But in actuality, it really was that album that leaked 5 hours ahead of time. And I'm not entirely convinced maybe Taylor and her team didn't do it themselves in order to whip up the crowd into a more of a frenzy. But certainly the album fits neatly between Folklore and Evermore. It's a little bit more calmer, but certainly the lyrics describe it as a revenge album, like Reputation did a number of years ago. She brings up a lot of old memories. There's still those, you know, kind of hidden secrets and Easter eggs that she likes to throw in there, talking about past relationships, which, you know, not to be sexist, but like nobody really, you know, kind of questioned Mick Jagger or Paul McCartney when he was writing his songs. But certainly Taylor Swift is able to have her personal life being an open book with an audience that is salivating over all the juicy details, and whatever she doesn't feel like revealing, she certainly has revealed most of it in these songs. So it's a pretty great double album.
How do you digest 31 songs as a fan? Do you listen in order? Is it like an old album that it follows a theme? How do you digest 31?
Yeah, I think, you know, for music reviewers who got their review out at about 3 o'clock in the morning, I think we're in a system that I'm not so thrilled with. You know, it takes a long time to digest an album, even just one that's not of Taylor Swift or Pearl Jam, who happened to release their album today as well. I think it takes time, and I think it needs to kind of sift a little bit and simmer into your brain to feel like how you handle it. But I think this album in particular is like a Pink Floyd album. You have to listen to it from start to finish, or at least in the order that the artist intended it to. The last couple of songs aren't really about other people. They're about her. And I think that it ends on a little bit of a high note. And as she kind of looks to the future, putting her these feelings and boarded, she even said that this period of her life is now over, the chapter closed and boarded up. And I think that she doesn't have any more scores to settle. I think the wounds have healed. And I think this is kind of the new, I hate to say it, it's like the new era of Taylor Swift, even though it seems like every month she's in a new era.
We saw that at Super Bowl. Do you think that this album came out the way it was planned? Do you think this was planned all along, or it just exploded into this?
Yeah. It's look, I know I'm busy. I know you are busy. I know your producer is busy. Taylor Swift has been busy in the things that we've seen.
Exactly.
She's done a worldwide tour that has over $1 billion worth of grosses. She has done a concert film and did her own negotiations between the movie theaters themselves, bypassing the traditional system. She's traveled to football games to see her boyfriend, Travis Cleese. She's appeared in various other videos and done social media really well. I don't even know how she was able to do all this stuff together, except for those little snippets of being on the road and sending it back to the producer. But, you know, it's pretty amazing that she was still able to do all of this under the guise of secrecy, that it didn't leak ahead of time. She didn't release any videos. She didn't release any songs. Actually, the first video comes out in 4.5 hours from now at 8 o'clock Eastern time. So, it's kind of still fascinating to watch, both as an insider of the industry, however close I can get, but also as a fan perspective and looking at the events and the opinions and the sentiments and the actions that not only Taylor does, but that surrounds Taylor is pretty astonishing to watch and listen as well.
Wow. Certainly another stage, not only in her career, but the music industry. The Tortured Poets Department, 31 songs. Taylor Swift's new one, Eric Elper on it, music publicist and commentary. Eric, thanks for the time. Get some sleep.
And guaranteed to sell one copy, thanks to your producer.
There you go.
If Scott Thompson isn't satisfied with an answer,
he'll delve into the issue until he is.
You're listening to Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson
on Hamilton's News, Today's Talk,
900 CHML.
A debate earlier this week, City Council and a group of people that want the LRT to be run by the city. Obviously, Metrolinx, who is building all of this, has final say over all of this. But an agreement has been reached. City Council backs the private LRT operation to start, but in 10 years, we'll take another look at this, revisit it, and see where we go from there. Is that based on what Metrolinx says? Let's bring in John Best, publisher of the Bay Observer, and here now. John, thanks for the time. Hope you're doing well.
Doing fine, Scott.
So, John, why are we having this discussion now? Many are saying we're debating who's going to drive the dang thing, and it ain't even built yet.
Yeah, I watched part of the debate. I must say I couldn't listen to all of it. I was almost embarrassed to see it's sort of tying in with what you're saying, like the question of when is any of this going to mean anything. To me, it was a waste of time. They would have, to my mind, would have been better to spend their time chartering a bus and go down to Port Dover and spend a pleasant day. it's going to be 10 years probably before the LRT would get built. And then they're talking about 10 years after that, that it's going to possibly revert to the city. It just seemed like just a total waste of time. It's so far down the road. You know, meanwhile, we've got major problems here in Hamilton, and this obsession with LRT, I think, has taken that council's eye off the ball. And frankly, it's been off the ball, not only with this council, but for the last 10 years at least.
I don't know where the focus has been, but it seems that with this decision now, John, that all bases are covered for the city. In other words, they got something to appease, and then it'll be at the end of the day, it's in Metrolink's hands anyway. Those that don't think so, or those that want this, are seeming to think if they put pressure on Metrolinx that somehow they'll change decision on this, because that's what they did with Toronto, but that's a different kettle of fish. What are your thoughts on the tactic here and the reason for doing this?
I don't think Metrolinx really cares what Hamilton says. We have a project. We have no skin in the game to speak of. The costs of building it are going to be picked up by the province and the feds, at least at this point. Although I don't detect any urgency whatsoever by either the province or Ottawa to get on with the project. So I don't know why we think we have this bargaining power. I mean, this council thought it was a good idea to pass a resolution to have the Mounties investigate Doug Ford. I mean, if that's their idea of government intergovernmental relations, we're in bad shape. At times, it seems to me that there's some of these folks are just plain delusional about how much clout we actually have here in Hamilton.
And what the kitchen table issues are. Now, let me ask you about this agreement. So they've decided, you know, we're going to let private do it for 10 years, and then we're going to revisit this and see what would. Does that have to be agreed to by Metrolinx?
Totally.
So none of that,
They could just tell us to have a nice day. There's no clout here whatsoever. It's it's a wet paper bag, really. The Metrolinx will do exactly what they want to do with regard to this project, and it's so far down the road that the issue of who's going to do what, Metrolinx may disappear. Who knows who's going to be running transit in Ontario? It was cranked up 10 years ago. Because the government of the day didn't trust MTO. They didn't trust MTO because MTO had a bias towards highways. So they thought, well, we better get transit out of the hands of those folks. And that's why we have Metrolinx. It was interesting, Scott, that Don Hull, who for many years was the director of transit here in Hamilton, he's posted a letter to the editor in the Spectator. It's in the online version right now. And he's basically saying, you know, when he was there, they put together something called Rapid Ready. And the whole plan of Rapid Ready was you start with Bus Rapid Transit. And Bus Rapid Transit, we kind of have that with the B line now. It's what they call BRT Light.
Yeah.
Bus Rapid Transit would, you know, be a more elaborate, probably bigger articulated buses and so on. But his whole thing was that we needed to, you know, we needed to walk before we run. And given the kind of ridership that the HSR had, the idea was let's build ridership to a point where it can support LRT. And my only argument with that is I'm not sure that we should be supporting LRT or any other transit system. The transit system should be supporting us. But nonetheless, he was ignored. His successor was basically forced out because they had this LRT tulip fever kind of thing going on, and they didn't want to hear practical people saying this is a leap too far for Hamilton.
Do you see death by delay? And in the end, Hamilton gets nothing.
What I think is rather than death by delay, I really wish this council would start developing a plan B, because I am not sure that the will is there. We haven't even talked about what the possible cost of the project is. it's certainly going to be more than the money that's been set aside.
So are you convinced, John, that the city council wants this LRT?
Well, I'm convinced that half of them do, although we have an interesting council now. Just recently, we suddenly become a gang of eight versus the hateful eight. So I'm not sure what the numbers are right at the moment. But certainly, whenever this has come up in front of council in the past, it's been approved. But I was talking to Eric Tuck, the head of the ATU, and they released that a public opinion survey that was ostensibly talking about whether they wanted public running the LRT or not. But there also was a reference in there to whether people wanted LRT or not.
Oh, man.
And he wouldn't share the number, but he did say that support for LRT in Hamilton has eroded. That was his language.
Wow. John Best with us, publisher of the Bay Observer. The great train debate continues. Thank you, John, as always. Have a great weekend.
You too.
It's Hamilton Today, 900 CHML in Hamilton. We're coming back.
You're listening to the Hamilton Today podcast from 900 CHML.
We remember that, and how can you forget? Because we heard about it for 3 weeks. Every day, another edition of Budget 2024 was released. And then finally, on April 16th, when it was actually Budget Day, the price tag and how we pay for it all. And a lot of that, a lot of that was thrown around was the middle class isn't going to be touched, and we're going to tax the wealthy, the ultra rich. And sort of talking about capital gains and that sort of thing. And then as people digested this over the last couple of days, it seems to be affecting a lot more people than just, well, wealthy people like the Prime Minister. Let's bring in Dr. Jack Mintz, Distinguished Fellow with the McDonnell Laurier Institute, President's Fellow of the School of Public Policy, University of Calgary. And the headlines are, why would anyone invest in Canada now? Jack, thanks for the time. I hope you're doing well.
I'm doing fine. Thank you.
So Justin Trudeau positioned this like he was taxing the rich, the ultra wealthy. Who's affected by this?
Well, a lot more than people than he might think. We have to remember that capital gains is, when people dispose their assets, it's a very lumpy kind of decision. You don't always do it. And a lot of people hold their assets for a very long time. You know, like small business owners, they don't go around selling their business every year and the shares that they have in their business. Same, even for people owning a cottage, you might use it for years to come. And then finally, at some point, you decide to sell it. And then you're going to have a big bang of capital gains in that one particular year. And yet in other years, you really don't have that much income. In fact, you might be just pretty middle class as a result. So there's going to be a lot more people that are affected. And maybe in 1 year, you have 0.13% of people that might pay tax. But then if you think of it as over 40 years, it might be a much bigger number, like 5 or 6% or 8% or 10% of people that will actually be paying capital gains tax on gains that are more than $250,000.
Would they have not have thought this through? Would government not have seen this? Or are they, looking down one path and not the others?
Well, I think the problem is that the federal government has been too focused on redistribution of the pie, giving, dental care and pharma care and having all sorts of policies to help help Canadians. When it comes to actually trying to pay for it, of course, then it's either run a deficit, which means all the young people today are going to be facing higher taxes in the future, or they end up saying, well, the rich can pay for it. But there's only so many times you can keep going to the rich, because after a while, some of those rich start moving out of the country, and that's what we've also seen happen.
I've heard one expert say exactly what you alluded to. This is redistribution of wealth. This is not wealth creation. Explain that.
Well, I think when you start raising taxes, especially on the people that create jobs through the kind of activities that they do, then you're going to actually have less wealth being created. Also, when you tax people's investments, they end up, and the returns that they get from investments, they can't accumulate capital as much for their retirement purposes. both of those things will happen. And then, but then of course, if you're getting revenues and you're giving it to people that, you know, that benefit from the government spending that's undertaken, in this case, it's not just, by the way, helping low-income people, it's also helping many wealthy people that are investing in green energy these days. So I think it's a, you know, it's a little more complicated in terms of who's benefiting from all the government spending that's going on right now.
Tax the rich, populist, left-wing populist comments. You know, sure, tax the rich. But when innovation, investment, and productivity is at an emergency state, according to the Bank of Canada, does that change this discussion?
Absolutely. I mean, we have gone through in the past year and a half an exceptional problem, and that is our income per capita has been declining. And in fact, it's expected to decline more this year. So we're talking about 2 years of and maybe more of a declining standard of living. And we're falling rapidly relative to the United States. And because of the much more business-friendly environment in the United States, despite all the rhetoric you might hear at times there, but it is more business-friendly there, that we are having people move down to the United States or they move elsewhere. They become effectively tax refugees, or they move their investment down to the United States or other countries where they feel they can do better. And so this is, as a result, we're having a declining standard of living, especially relative to the United States. And this is getting to be an emergency, as the Bank of Canada has pointed out.
Do you think that we certainly know where the Liberal Party is, the governing party is in the polls and such. Many have said that this is going to be used as a wedge issue. The whole idea is to ignite the Conservatives and then position the Conservatives like, see, they don't want to tax the rich. They don't want the rich to pay their fair share. Are Canadians buying that? Are they buying in?
I don't think so. I think people are now starting to get very worried about, you know, kind of long run prospects for the country. And you're hearing that a lot, amongst people in the business community. For example, I talk to a lot of people here in Toronto and in Calgary, and I'm getting the same message. It's not that much different. And I think that people are also, worried about inflation. And making ends meet, and because of the much higher prices that we've seen over the past 3 years, the accumulated increase in prices that we've seen for just basics like food and everything else, that if people's incomes don't keep up, and that's what happened initially, particularly they start saying, well, gee, maybe it's more than just what the government does for me. We got to have a strong private sector. And of course, you need a private sector that's strong if you want to pay for all the government spending that goes on. Because if there's not enough tax revenue coming in, the government ends up running bigger deficits unless they really cut back spending.
What happens now, Jack? It's a year and a half to the next election. Looks like the NDP is going to support this. What happens now? And there might be even another budget between now and then and another one of these Hail Marys.
I can guarantee you that next year's budget will be even more spending than what we've seen in this budget. I am concerned about the direction that Canada's taking, and it is scaring away capital. We've had quite a capital outflow coming out of the country. We're not talking about a few billion. We're talking about $200 billion that has left the country. And it is a very significant issue that people are voting with their feet. And it's because they don't see the returns on capital. And in fact, even the finance minister has been trying to cajole the pension funds to invest in Canada. But if you're trying to keep workers' pensions up, you have to get the best returns possible internationally. And pension funds are investing elsewhere. And why not? Because if you've invested in the U.S. stock market, for example, you're doing much better than if you've invested in the Canadian stock market over the past while. So I think we really need to start paying attention to growing the economy and not just redistributing wealth.
Why would anyone invest in Canada now? Post-budget? Dr. Jack Mintz with us, distinguished fellow with McDonald Laurier Institute and President's Fellow of the School of Public Policy, University of Calgary. Jack, thanks so much for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
Thank you, Scott. Bye-bye.
We've certainly heard a lot about the ArriveCan app from way back when during the height of the global pandemic. And then as this company or this this whole situation, this whole app was audited, we found out this it goes to the home of two people working on it. And then as an inquiry continues, RCMP search executives offices, the founder, co-founder, Kristen Firth of CG Strategies, also the home of an ArriveCan contractor. Where is this? Where does it go moving forward? To decode it all, Chris Sims with us, Alberta Director of the Canadian Taxpayers Federation, and here now. Chris, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Doing very well. Thanks for having us on.
So, Chris, we saw the testimony earlier today from Kristen, or earlier this week from Kristen Firth. He wasn't saying much. He was admonished by the House of Commons. The significance of all of this, decode it for us.
So it's significant no matter what is going on here. The very fact that we had a private citizen called before the bar, as it's referred to. And in this case, quite often people would be familiar with that. Some of my lawyer friends will be familiar with that in their own practices and what they're doing as lawyers. But in this case, it's literal. There's a big brass bar at the front of the House of Commons. Anybody who's gone to visit Parliament Hill can see it. And what is being called before the bar here is when a citizen is called in front of it. So you have to stand there in front of the House of Commons and look directly at the speaker. And so you've got the government then, if you're looking at the speaker, government will be on your left side. Opposition will be on your right. And you're basically then admonished by the speaker. So in this case, it usually looks like a judge. So the speaker's wearing, looks like judge's robes, black and white robes. And then you're questioned quite often by members of parliament. And this is because, in this case, the individual was found to not be answering questions at committee. And so I guess this is a really good reminder for people about how our parliamentary system works, how the committee system works. In many cases, if you are called to testify before a committee, that's literally what you're doing. And if you refuse to answer questions, you can, in essence, it's not the right term, but you can, in essence, be found in contempt and then called before the bar to be rung out by the speaker. And I think, I was checking the article, I think the last time this happened to a private individual was back in like the 1910s or something like that. And I believe it happened quite more recently with a bureaucrat I think it was connected to Health Canada at some point. But yes, it was quite the spectacle.
So what happens to Mr. Firth and all of this moving forward? How does that change things? How do you proceed?
Well, the investigation, as they say, is ongoing. And so I think what we're going to have to wait and do is find out what all of the testimony is going to be. Because who knows who the committee is going to bring forward in the future. Maybe they'll turn up other evidence. Maybe there will be more testimony. Maybe others will refuse to so-called give evidence at this committee. And again, this is not where somebody has been found, I want to be very careful, has not been found criminally responsible for something. It's a method of investigation. It's a way of getting rigorously at information that taxpayers and citizens of Canada need to know. So as far as I understand, there's been no conviction of court or any wrongdoing found. But the reason why it has to happen like this is because, again, this was all the so-called public purse. People might remember back when all of this started happening that, number one, people had a lot of problems with the ArriveCan app. In many cases, it wasn't working for people. Then we found out that it should have cost us two different IT people over a long weekend as an experiment, tried recreating the app. And they did it for around $250,000, whereas the ArriveCan app itself cost taxpayers close to $60 million. So to have something just balloon in cost like that, you're going to have people asking tough questions, and that's exactly what's happening in Ottawa.
So is this company, CG Strategies, in trouble, or is the government? Why would they not want to speak, and is it not in their best interest, or is this fraudulent or a bad deal?
That's a great question. That's something that we're going to have to, at the Taxpayers Federation, we leave that up to the legal beagles, right? Because I'm sure there are a lot of people calling their lawyers over this case. We fundamentally want government held accountable. So we stand for lower taxes, less waste, accountable government. And at this point, I think a lot of the questions are directed at the department. Who decided to give, you know, subcontracts or to give a company the ability to create this software? Who decided it? And why did they sign these contracts? Fundamentally, the buck does stop, we think, with government, because they're the ones with access to the treasury. They're the ones with access to our funds. A private company cannot just, you know, walk into the treasury and take taxpayers' money. Fundamentally, the responsibility does land with government. And I think right now, we're kind of watching the guts of the investigation play out in Ottawa so far that we're seeing a private citizen, again, quite the spectacle, a person in a gray suit, private citizen, not a bureaucrat, called before the speaker, called before the bar.
In government, is this another case of the left hand not knowing what the right hand is doing?
Great question. Don't know. We got to see this, because every now and then I'll figure that we've heard the last of it at committee, and then it escalates. And you wind up having somebody call before the bar in front of the speaker. So at the end of the day, we're going to have to look at all the testimony, and we do need answers. The Taxpayers Federation ourselves, we even gave testimony at committee, one of the previous incarnations of it, and basically just asked all these questions. Who decided to pay this amount of money? Who decided to hire this company? Where is the responsibility and accountability of government? And so in this case, again, it's very interesting to see the thoroughness and the lengths that they're going to, but we ultimately need to have answers coming from the government as to why they thought this was an acceptable use of taxpayers' money. And again, we have to remind ourselves, this was all during the lockdowns. This was all during a lot of questionable practices of whether or not we could cross it, we could cross our own border.
I'm sure, Chris, it has a lot to do with the Prime Minister just not getting the information and not knowing what was going on. We'll have to wait and see.
Read your briefing notes, kids. If you become Prime Minister, do not skim that stuff. Yeah.
Chris Sims, Alberta Director, Canadian Taxpayers Federation. Thanks so much. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.
When there's an issue, Scott is all in on getting to the heart of it.
This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson.
On Hamilton's News, Today's Talk.
900 CHML.
We remember for the last, I'd say 3 weeks, this started the end of March when the Prime Minister announced that he was going to be daily making another announcement of the budget. A lot of the reason for this, instead of unloading the budget in one day and only getting a day or two coverage out of it, and perhaps the odd preview or leak at the very beginning, the government is convinced that they haven't been doing a very good job of communicating with Canadians, selling them their policy and such. So every day, another $1 billion and another set of promises came out pre-budget. And then when the budget came down April 16th, it was basically how we're going to pay for this. And the Prime Minister referenced several times that it was only going to be the wealthiest Canadians that were going to have to pay. Middle class would be spared. And then announced increases to the capital gains tax. It took a day or two to settle in, but the fallout has many middle-class Canadians concerned, as this affects more than just the wealthiest Canadians. To talk more, David MacDonald with us, senior economist with the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, and here now. David, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Sure thing. Thanks for having me.
The Prime Minister saying this would affect the wealthiest of Canadians. Is that accurate?
I mean, this will be primarily paid by people who, with average incomes of $1.4 million a year, they make up the top 0.12% of Canadians, about 40,000 people out of 41 million, that would pay this increased capital gains inclusion rate. When it comes to regular Canadians, if you've got money in an RRSP, a TFSA, you've changed your RRSP into a RIF, even if you have huge portfolios in there, you're completely unaffected. If you have a house that you live in that you need to sell for some reason, if you want to pass on a house in a will to your kids, or you want to pass on your house to your kids to live in, you're completely unaffected by this.
You sound like it's a great idea, Dave. What's everybody so upset about?
Well, I mean, this is the thing, is that is that the big program in the budget was a housing program. There's a huge housing unaffordability crisis in Canada. And so the increase in this capital gains inclusion rate was meant to attempt to pay for trying to make housing, particularly rental housing, more affordable in Canada with a big new plan. And it's, you know, it's a decent plan. It's a plan that starts to get to the level of need that we have in this country for more affordable, particularly rental housing. A lot of zoning bylaws to help, build more just regular for sale housing as well.
Don't want to spend a lot of time on the housing plan because it was announced in 2015 and the opposition and many housing experts that we've had on over the last several years have endorsed this because it should have been done long ago. It was promised long ago and housing experts and the opposition have finally, I guess, made their point to the government. That's not the point, is who is this going to cost or who is going to pay for this? And you're making it sound as if it's only the extremely rich as opposed to those that may have a rental property, those that are like a plumber or a carpenter who may have their own business, a doctor who may have their own business using corporations. There's a lot more that this affects than that 1%. Is that not accurate?
Well, what's interesting on the small business sale, so this is a part of the plan, they actually increased the lifetime exemption for the sale of small businesses, say a plumbing business, for instance. So instead of getting $1 million completely tax-free, that's gone up to $1.25 million completely tax-free, and then that amount is indexed to inflation over time, and so it will continue to grow. So for small businesses, depending on, if you're selling a $2 or $3 million business, you're not, you made $3 million in the sale of a business, but you're not middle class anymore. You're well into the upper end.
And you get a big discount. Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness. David, who is buying that, David? Productivity down, innovation down, investment down, innovation. Like, come on, David.
So what was
like, are you in the Liberal Party? I can't believe you're selling this the way you are.
Well, what's interesting is that we actually saw this level of tax rates on capital gains in the 1990s, through the 1990s, introduced by Mulroney in 88 and then upped again by Mulroney in 90. And then it stayed at that level over the course of the 1990s. We actually saw corporate investment over that entire period. I mean, this is obviously a threat. Is corporate investment going to go down because capital gains tax rates are marginally higher. We see over that period that corporate investment skyrockets over that period, goes from 3.5% of GDP up to 6% of GDP.
Then why are we where we are now? That doesn't make sense. David Dodge said this is one of the worst budgets he's seen. Very well-respected man. You're selling the exact opposite. I don't understand.
Yeah, I mean, this is the pitch from businesses. They don't want to pay tax and that they promise to take any tax savings that they make and invest that in productive pursuits, say buying better machinery and equipment for their workers, improving their factories, training their workers better, spending on a workplace training, that sort of thing. That was the promise in the early 2000s when the big corporate income tax cuts came down, which is sort of a broader package than just capital gains. The trouble is you don't have to spend it that way. You can also spend it paying out big money to your execs, or paying out for your shareholders. The truth is that companies invest when the economy is good and they don't invest when the economy is bad. Because first of all, your goal of the company is to make money. You want to declare a profit. Yeah, you're going to have to pay a bit of that back in tax and the tax rates change from time to time.
But that's what creates productivity, innovation, and investment. I mean, that's the whole idea. Is big business a bad word now, David? Like building was a bad word in the last 10 or 20 years?
Well, I think what we need to say is economic growth is a good word, and that's what we need. And one of the big constraints on economic growth right now is high housing costs. We think this is like an individual problem, right? Oh, folks can't find a cheap place to rent anymore. This is a serious business.
Nobody's debating the housing issue, David. We know it's a self-inflicted wound because nobody's built for the last 5, 10, 15, 20 years. But it's how you're going to pay for that. And if this is really the right way to go, you can't keep saying, "Well, everybody, we need this." Well, of course you need that, but that's not the issue. The issue is this the right way to pay for it? Is this going to stifle productivity, investment, innovation in the country? And is it going to affect the middle class?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly didn't in the 90s. So this is a measure that's well targeted to be outside.
It's not the 90s.
But this is what I'm saying, is we've done this before, and investment did not plummet. In fact, it went up. So, I mean, you know, we have a historical precedent for this. This is a measure that is well targeted towards folks at the higher end that make more money on capital gains. Most folks aren't paid in capital gains. They're paid in, you know, regular wages. There's quite a discount on income that happens to be capital gains vis-a-vis wages, which makes it preferential for you to trade assets. And so you pay at a lower rate if you trade assets versus sweeping floors. Is this a way to start to equalize that? And, you know, I think this is a fair trade in terms of, we need this housing investment. How do we pay for it, and who should pay for it? Should it be middle-class Canadians, or should it be wealthier Canadians who've done really well out of the boom in real estate prices?
All right, David McDonald with us, senior economist, Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives, saying, hey, it's all good. No need to worry or panic. Thank you, David. We've talked about these situations before, and people who scam you, whether it's through your cell phone, your phones, your credit cards, what have you. And it's obviously a big issue with seniors, and them getting swindled out of money in various ways. Now we're hearing 14 have been arrested after a grandparent scam swindles more than $2.2 million from Canadian seniors since 2022. 14 people. It shows you the magnitude, the scale of some of these operations. Let's bring in John Armid, acting detective sergeant of the Anti-Rackets branch with the Canadian Anti-Fraud Center. And here now, John, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Thanks, Scott. Thanks for having me. I'm doing great.
So tell us about this specific scam, or these specific scams, how they would work, how they would play out to the average person.
Yeah, so in my role at the Canadian Anti-Fraud Center, we've seen this this issue rear its head a few years ago and really start to get traction. And so the OPP and our joint forces, including Hamilton Police Service, were able to start to look into this in 2022 as an intelligence probe. And by 2023, in February, we formalized the probe and looked into what's called the emergency grandparent scam. And as a result of that investigation, we end up arresting 14 people and laying 56 charges. But the way this fraud happens is these individuals will call seniors that have landlines, and they'll purport to be a family member that's in an emergency. And the way they get these people's numbers is they go to Canada 411, type in a postal code, and they'll have the name, the phone number, and the address of these seniors. And so they'll claim that the grandchildren or the family member is in peril. They've just been arrested. Maybe they've been involved with a car accident. The different ruses that come up all the time, and saying that they need bail to get out of court. These individuals, they're really, really convincing. And then they'll hand the senior over or hand the phone over to another person. And the senior believes that they're now talking to a police officer, or a lawyer, or a judge, saying that in order to get the family member out, they got to pay cash. And there's a gag order.
Wow. So nothing new. I mean, as you mentioned, John, you've heard this a bazillion times, but I guess obviously they are so convincing. They seem to be able to catch victims. 14 people arrested. That sounds like this is very well organized. Are all of these related, or are these separate situations?
No, these are 14 individuals that we believe that were associated to this one particular cell. So I actually had the honor of going and working with their Quebec partners last week in effecting the arrest. And one of the individuals I were arrested was one of the main callers. And it was interesting hearing him with a convincing voice. And he would call and say, "Hey, Grandma, it's me." And the grandparent would say, "Who is that?" And he'd say, "You know, your favorite grandchild." And that's how they elicit the information. It's almost like a cold call. And you're hitting these people that are, you know, shocked that, you know, their family member's in peril. And so, you know, if they don't pay up, that's when we'd see these people just be vicious on the phone with these elderly people. And we've heard these people cry, you know, and threaten to come to their house and kill them. Now, that never happened, but, you know, these poor seniors are sitting in their homes alone now panicking. It's very devastating.
How organized is this? I mean, it sounds like it's very well planned.
It absolutely is. And this is all connected to traditional organized crime. So what we see is these intermediaries that they would dispatch to go physically attend the individual's residence to pick up the cash. Now, often these couriers may not know exactly what they're doing. They may have been, you know, hired through different online classified ads, or just, you know, through a friend of a friend, hey, can, you know, go to this place, here's the address, go pick up the cash and then drop it off at an undisclosed location, leave the money and walk away. So it causes that isolation and intermediaries. And it worked out brilliantly for these folks.
We've had many people such as yourself on, John, and they say, obviously, if it sounds too suspicious, if it just doesn't add up, it probably doesn't. Hang up the phone, call somebody else, try to verify. And it seems we've talked about this a lot, but the message just doesn't seem to be resonating.
Absolutely. And the challenge is with this demographic is they may not be in social media. They may not watch TV as much. It may not be on the radio as much. And they're not going to their, you know, coffee shops and having magazines out because of the, you know, the attrition and a lot of the media. So, you know, it's a challenge getting the messaging out. But we want to tell people, first of all, no police will come to your door and ask for cash. It absolutely never happens. If you suspect someone's calling about your relative, hang up the phone and call that relative directly. And never send any cash, cryptocurrency, gift cards, or send e-transfers to people you don't know. And that really is a simplistic message. But when you're caught in this chaos and this stress, sometimes common sense gets thrown out the window momentarily.
You know, it's interesting that when people start being asked to deliver stuff or buy gift cards or what have you, that doesn't immediately shoot off red flags, but obviously it should.
And I've arrested some of these couriers as well. And, you know, they claim they don't know. But, you know, one thing that really was successful, it was members of the public actually calling the police. Those police doing detailed reports and capturing the information and then sharing that with the Canadian Anti-Fraud Center. And at the Canadian Anti-Fraud Center, we're able to capture that information and directly provide that intelligence and tactical information to the investigative units, which really helped out their investigation. So it really was a group effort, and we couldn't have done it without our policing partners and the public themselves.
So if you get one of these calls, obviously, if you're suspicious, do as you say, try to verify, hang up, move on. But then what do we do? Should we report this to the Canadian Anti-Fraud Center?
Absolutely. The Canadian Anti-Fraud Center is a 1-888 number, but you can go to the Canadian Anti-Fraud Center website. You can learn more about this. We have a list of A to Z and all the fraud types, but also you can report online. And it really doesn't take a lot of time, but that information really is available. And one of the other things that most people know about the Anti-Fraud Center is we have a disruption program. So if there's a bad bank account, a bad phone number, bad email address, we work and disseminate that. Obviously, you know, we comply with the privacy laws, but we send that off to disrupt the tools that these fraudsters have, whether they're in Canada or internationally, to disrupt their operations.
Many think that this is all overseas, but here's an arrest made right here by the OPP.
Absolutely. OPN, our partners. And we also have the bank investigator scam, which is very similar. So again, if you have a landline, you know, just be cautious on who's calling you and be okay with hanging up and saying, you know, maybe there's a number I can call you back on and verifying things. But that, you know, that's the key. It's just hang up.
John Arnott with us, Acting Detective Sergeant, Anti-Rackets Branch for the Canadian Anti-Fraud Center. 14 arrested after grandparent scam swindles $2.2 million from Canadian seniors. John, thanks for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
Thanks for covering the story. Appreciate chatting with you.
Scott Radley Show coming up after the 6 o'clock news. Read him in your Hamilton Spectator. He is here now. Scott, I hope you're doing well.
I am great. How are you doing?
I'm doing very good. So I don't know if you remember this or not, but a while ago, I think it was in a week or so ago, the government asked the banks to change the name of the carbon tax refund that you, when it appears on your check, because I guess when it's directly deposited, it just says federal payment or tax refund or something like that. And the government wanted that changed, so when you get that, it would say Canada Carbon Rebate on the deposit, on the thing, on the
yeah.
So the bank said no. And then now I read Canadian banks that refuse to identify the carbon rebate by name when doing direct deposits are forcing the government to change the law to make them do it, says the environment minister. So they've now changed the law. So when your money appears, it will appear not as a federal payment or a tax refund, but as the carbon Canada carbon rebate. It amazes me that, you know, a government that has spent the last 6 months as they're plummeting the polls saying, you just don't understand us. We're not doing a good job of explaining everything to you. And then they take like 3 weeks to unveil a budget day by day by day by day by day. And then when people still don't like it, they come up with stuff like this. It just amazes me. We get the message. We're just not happy with it. What are your thoughts?
Scott, it's not all that much different from our city council, who wanted on our tax bill to have something marked as what is the amount that we've increased your taxes by and what is the result of the province. And and here's what I really believe most, it seems, many, although I tend to lean towards most, politicians seem to very, very, very quickly forget as soon as they become politicians. There is one taxpayer. We don't give a flying whatever who's charging us, because it's if the federal government downloads stuff to the province and the province downloads stuff to the city, you and me and everyone listening are still the ones paying. Yeah. It doesn't matter which wallet it's going into. We are still paying. And so they can play all these semantic games or advertising games.
Rebranding
games. It doesn't matter. At the end of the day, and sorry for the cliche, I hate that phrase, but I used it. It is our money that is paying for this, and we don't care who it is. We just know that we are a lot worse off right now. We have a lot less money in our pocket because all levels of government are gouging us. So go ahead and rebrand all you want. We hate all of it. We are tired of all of it. I'm serious. We are completely fatigued. And maybe people listening will disagree, but I don't think so.
No.
We are fatigued with the fact that politicians cannot seem to show any restraint when it comes to spending. They all decide they have to do everything, they have to be everything for everyone, and they never seem to care that they aren't the ones paying. You know, we always hear, these are government-funded programs. You want to know something? There is not one government-funded program, Scott. They are taxpayer-funded programs.
It's like affordable housing. What's affordable housing? Affordable housing means subsidized housing, because there is no affordable housing until supply outstretches demand.
Well,
so,
down in the States,
I mean, affordable is, it's subsidized.
Down in the States, Joe Biden just recently announced he got knocked down by the Supreme Court the first time, but then came back with a new version. And he's going to get rid of, university tuition. He's going to forgive tuitions, except he's not forgiving tuitions. This is not coming out of the Joe Biden Philanthropic Foundation. This is coming from taxpayers who now bank. And even if you say, well, the banks are the ones who are going to be forced to do this, the banks are not just going to have shareholders eat this. Yeah. They're going to pass this on. Every time a politician opens his or her mouth,
everything's
says,
free.
So, you know, one of the best ones is a number of years ago, Kawhi Leonard, after the Raptors won the championship and he was a free agent, I believe it was the federal health minister, but it could have been provincial. Anyway, one of the two put out a tweet saying, hey, Kawhi, stay in Canada because there's free health care. And I just remember at that time thinking, of all the people, we pay more per capita in our taxes for healthcare than any other country in the world. If you want to say we have universal healthcare, we have included healthcare, we have covered healthcare, it's not free. And yet somehow politicians tell us free. We just had, I can't remember which politician was just talking about all the free stuff that we're getting in this budget. It's not free. Yeah. Nothing is. Politicians, Scott, I am convinced, as soon as they are elected, their brain, there's a switch that someone, they go back behind the scenes and someone flicks it off, and their ability to think rationally about money goes away. They become completely incapable of handling finances, because there's not one of them, it seems, that does a good job about this.
Did you see that piece that was on the Bill Maher show on Canada?
Yes.
All right, enough said.
No. And here's the thing about that, and if people haven't seen it, go watch it. Bill Maher is, I would argue, well to the left of the political center.
Yes.
He is saying, we are crazy to the left now. If you've got someone who is already a strong, small L liberal saying, boy, you guys are crazy. You're like, your liberalism is out of control. You might want to listen a little bit to that and go, okay, you know, he's not, Bill Maher is not the arbiter of everything good or bad in the world.
No.
But surely people like that, you might want to perk up your ear and say, okay, have we overshot the center here a little bit?
Scott Radley coming up after the 6 o'clock news. Read him in your Hamilton Spectator. Have a great show and weekend, Scott.
You too.
Thanks for listening to the Hamilton Today podcast. You can listen to the show live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 on 900 CHML and online at 900CHML.com.
That's it for us. Thanks for listening. As always, we leave it to you, the taxpaying customer, to have the last word. This one via email from Danny. Only an idiot would cut off energy from an ally and then buy it from an enemy who calls for your death. Keep right, except to pass.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink. All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone, like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.